KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Hello and welcome to the Space Policy edition of Planetary Radio. I'm Casey Dreyer, the Chief of Space Policy here at the Planetary Society. Good to be here this month. I am very excited about our guest, Dr. Janet Vertesi, Associate Professor of Sociology at Princeton University, who for the last two decades has studied not just NASA's robotic spacecraft, but the teams that enable them. She's embedded herself and watched the various sociological engagements and interactions and what makes these teams tick as they explore the solar system via their robotic emissaries, in a sense. Her insights on teamwork and how knowledge is passed forward is reflected in two books that she's written. The first was called Seeing Like a Rover, How Robots, Teams, and Images Craft Knowledge of Mars. And her latest book that came out a few years ago, Shaping Science, Organizations, Decisions, and Culture on NASA's Teams. They are truly unique resources in terms of understanding, in a sense, how the actual process of exploration occurs with robotic scientific spacecraft. It's truly fascinating. But that's not even the exact reason she's on the show this month. That's part of it. Why she's here is a op-ed that she published recently that is linked to in our show notes. It's called Invigorating the American Space Sector Requires Working with NASA, Not Against It. The period in which I'm recording this is a period of incredible uncertainty for NASA itself, what its future is going to be, what its budgets are going to look like, and how many people it will even have. At this point, again, in April of 2025, NASA narrowly avoided laying off over 1,000 workers called probationary, which were basically young, new, early career individuals and people who had just been promoted. NASA has, though, lost nearly 5% of its workforce through voluntary buyouts offered by the current administration. And while those departures are voluntary, a reduction in 5% of NASA's workforce actually places the agency at its smallest civil servant workforce level since 1960, essentially. Now, what the right level of workforce is, isn't necessarily the point of this discussion. What is the point, and which is the article that she talked about made the point of, is that institutions themselves, particularly institutions like NASA that are charged with doing something, let's be honest, kind of weird, right? Charged with exploring the universe, with sending people into space, with, you know, pushing the boundaries of capability of these weird one-off technologies to land on Mars or to go to Jupiter or to build a super cold spacecraft that can look back towards the early stages of the universe. These aren't something that you just pick up in a book. You figure out how to do this. In a sense, the larger institutional workforce of NASA shares this broad knowledge. It's too complex and too big for any one brain. And Dr. Vertesi's work is basically this study, and her op-ed makes this argument that if you don't preserve this institutional knowledge through the act of doing things and working together in teams, that knowledge can die, can and does die. There is no, you know, we often think that once a genie is out of the bottle in knowledge for humanity, there's no putting it back in. But she actually argues it has happened many times, and particularly in civilization's deep history. We forget things all the time. knowledge is an active process. And if there's this concept of this broader meta, in a sense, meta brain of a group capability and group awareness and group expertise, randomly losing people and driving, either driving them out of the workforce or applying arbitrary levels of workforce cuts, you're poking holes in that group brain and weakening the ability to institutionalize and to maintain this hard-earned knowledge that we have for space exploration. I think about this, that I came away from this discussion with the idea that NASA, in a sense, functions as a national strategic reserve of knowledge for how to get to and operate in space successfully. The conversation I'm about to have with Dr. Vertesi touches on her article, which I again recommend you read, and the importance of actively maintaining institutional knowledge, particularly for activities like going into space, because of its complexity, because of its, you know, unforgiving nature of space itself. And it's a really important point to consider as we are in a situation where we are trying to reduce the capabilities, or at least reduce the workforce levels of NASA. How can you do that if it has to happen in a way that preserves knowledge? And as she'll point out, it's not just enough to assume that the individuals laid off will go and found new companies or bring that full knowledge with them. They'll bring bits and pieces, but there's no guarantee, unless there's some broader effort, that that knowledge will take root and be maintained over time. Before we get to that interview, the Planetary Society is a nonprofit, member-supported organization. That means we rely on individuals to be members and support us financially in order so we can do all of the great work that we do here at the organization, all the outreach, all the education, obviously organizing our members to engage with their political systems and argue for space exploration and space science, and bring you shows like this and the weekly show Planetary Radio. Memberships start at just $4 a month. You can pay more. I encourage you to do so. Again, we literally depend on our members. We do not take corporate money and we do not take government money. We exist solely by, and our independence is enabled by, members. Hopefully you, that I'm talking to right now. But if not, consider joining us. It truly does make a difference. That's planetary.org/join. I will add that as you hear this at this period of recording when this show just came out, we are also fundraising specifically for our advocacy and policy program. That's at planetary.org/donate. You can see a section there that directly funds the work that me and my colleague Jack Corrale do in Washington, D.C., and all the outreach and analysis and the unique capabilities that we provide to this broader space industry. That's planetary.org/donate or planetary.org/join. Please consider supporting us. And now, joining me is Dr. Janet Vertesi. Janet Vertesi, thank you for joining me this month on the Space Policy Edition.
Of course, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Casey.
I have linked in the show notes to the great article that you wrote about the threats to NASA's workforce and the loss of that. And something that you opened that article with really stuck out to me, which was you, and I'll just kind of quote you here, you say, "It is possible, even easy, to systematically forget or lose entire swaths of technical or scientific prowess." Why does that happen? Has it happened in our past, at least in the modern era? And what do we need to do to preserve, in a sense, and sustain human knowledge over time?
It's a good question. Human knowledge, we tend to think of belonging to individual people or sitting somehow in our heads that could be sort of extractable from an individual. But knowledge of the type that it takes to do these enormous technical projects is a group endeavor, and it's a group collective phenomenon. So we talk about this as a question of distributed cognition, for instance, that it doesn't take just one person to put together a Boeing 747. I mean, there's many, many different people involved, many different groups, many different clusters of knowledge that have to come together. And then a lot of knowledge that we don't ever write down, that it escapes documentation. We call that tacit knowledge in sociology. It means the unspoken or quiet knowledge. If you've ever tried to explain to a child how to ride a bicycle, using words or how to brush their teeth using words, you'd know that that goes awry very quickly. And it's because there's so much more that we don't express verbally. So when you put those two things together, one, that knowledge is a property of groups, and two, that a lot of knowledge about, you know, technical know-how cannot actually be expressed in documentation, you see what happens when you have these large technical projects that suddenly lose institutional backing. Everybody who knows what they're doing suddenly escapes the project. And it means that you've lost a tremendous amount of technical knowledge, potentially absolutely crippling technical knowledge. You've lost the ability to send something into space, to put something effectively or safely in the air, to manage a railroad, for instance. I mean, if you trouble the institutions in which individuals work collectively and transmit that tacit knowledge from one generation to the next and are able to bring their knowledge together across different clusters, then you do actually uninvent technologies. So this is known as the tacit uninvention of a technology, because you've lost the stories, the know-how, the mentorship, and also the collective knowledge that it takes to make a project work.
And have there been examples of that that we've seen in history, in recent history?
I'm trying to think about, I mean, there's a lot of knowledge that we lose, right? Because
I guess we wouldn't know if we've lost. I guess,
yeah, it's hard to know if you lost it. I mean,
in your article, I guess I'm thinking about Apollo, as returning to the moon, maybe as an example that's relevant to this discussion.
Yeah, I think the Apollo case is a really interesting one, because America spent a ton of money getting to the moon. I mean, it was basically like blank checks to get Apollo off the ground and get it to the moon successfully over successive waves of missions. So what was interesting about Apollo wasn't just the technology, it was the institution, the organization. What NASA did, and people like James Webb, the original James Webb, talk about this explicitly, what NASA did was set up an organization in which people worked on successive Apollos to stepwise make it to the moon. And they transferred their knowledge by working, like someone would work on Apollo, I don't know, 2, and then another group would work on Apollo 3, and then that group from Apollo 2 would also transfer to 4 and 5. And so you had this kind of infusion of knowledge over the long term between one group and the next. And what that meant is each stage built successively on the prior technology demonstration, as well as with the prior groups of people. So you had that knowledge go over time. And then the other thing that someone like James Webb said is what was interesting about these big projects at NASA is, like, you can't do this with a small group. You have to do this at scale. It is such a difficult and large thing to do. I mean, space is there to kill us, let's remind ourselves. So if we really want to get humans to some place as inhospitable as the moon and difficult, we have to bring lots of organizations together in ways that they hadn't really worked before. And so what you end up with is these large organizations that extend out between the public and the private sector, but at the same time, a group of people that work together quite concertedly over, you know, 10 or 12 years in order to make something like Apollo happen. And so as an organizational sociologist who studies technology in high-tech spaces, this is a really fascinating kind of organization, because it means that they maintain and build on all that tacit knowledge. They can work with distributed cognition to make the whole, apparatus come together. And then it's not lost until Nixon says, that's it, we're done. We're spending too much on the Vietnam War. It's 1970. The Nixon Doctrine comes in and says, okay, NASA, you don't get blank checks anymore. Now you're subject to the same style of funding as many of these other agencies. You have to go to Congress every year, every 2 years, and present a budget. It has to be debated. This money isn't just, you know, coming out of nowhere anymore. And that's when, you know, as we've seen in your work, for instance, Casey, we've seen massive withdrawal of funds from NASA. I mean, the budget crashed by 2/3, right? And that made it so that people who worked on Apollo had to leave, and that knowledge left with them. And I think the idea was, look, it's great, we've built this capability, now it'll go out into the private sector, or it'll go out to reinfuse more NASA projects. But it didn't. It didn't, because you can write down how to build a spacecraft, but you need that team, you need that longevity, you need that tacit knowledge, and you need that group know-how. And without that, we literally lost the ability to go to the moon. I mean, we basically forgot how to do that collectively. And as time went on, as those people came to the ends of their careers, as those people passed away, that knowledge died with them. And that group knowledge died with them. And so that's a fear I have when I look at the kind of funding scenarios for NASA right now, is we're facing a similar moment as we faced in 1970. The idea that, like, oh, it's okay, we're spending too much on this right now. It'd be much better if we sent most of these people to the private sector and they'll keep doing the good work there. The problem is, if you deinstitutionalize those people, if you break up the band, so to speak, like, they don't play together again, and they might play different music, but it will not be the same thing. And in many cases, we may lose the ability to do the things that we now do so expertly in space and do the best in the world in space.
There's like five things I want to follow up from that.
Do it,
Janet.
I'd like to hear it. Yes.
I mean, the first is just I want to just maybe talk a little bit more about the idea of group knowledge, because I think there's it seems counterintuitive, or just maybe not intuitive, maybe in a way, for how humans tend to think about other humans, that there's this idea of, like, you know, this the singular genius or the individual who is responsible for something, and it's in someone's brain that then, or maybe in a more modern parlance, some captain of industry who can come and marshal and through kind of some Nietzschean will to power shape the world to their whims. But this isn't it. This is saying that there is something about that knowledge exists, it's distributed, but also in the interactions themselves, which is maybe some interesting epistemological challenge and to me understanding this. So is it the dynamics itself, in a sense, have some emergent knowledge property come out of that?
Well, I think, I'm not saying that humans don't have their own brains and they don't think themselves and they don't have knowledge. I mean, they do. But we also have this other property, which is that humans work collectively in groups and in teams. And in teams, humans can do way more than they can do alone. I think culturally, especially in the West, especially in America, we have this fantasy or ideal of the, you know, the singular cowboy who can, like, do all the things, or the genius who's going to be able to do it all themselves. But when you actually look at the history of science and technology, it was never a single person. They often had wives that were assisting them in the laboratory. They had entire laboratory assistants. They were interacting with other scientists. They were working with other people's tools and technologies. You're never doing it all alone. And that's okay. I mean, humans are also an interdependent group species. We have ways of organizing ourselves. That's another thing humans do as primates, right? I think the other thing that's interesting is, you know, I've done a lot of work with NASA teams for the last 20 years, and my most recent book, Shaping Science, looks at how different teams organize themselves in order to do their science on Mars or at Saturn. And one of the things I found that was so provocative in that book was that I was looking at these two teams that were concurrent, these two exploration teams that were happening concurrently, and they were happening at many of the same institutions, and they even involved the same people. And those people behaved differently depending on the structure and the organization of the group that they were in. And, like, literally, you could go from one meeting in the morning with somebody and they behave one way, and then you see them at another meeting in the afternoon and they behave entirely differently. So humans are also really good at code switching as they move from one group to another. But this really helps demonstrate that organizations and teams are also super fundamental to how humans operate. And if that's kind of a bit of, you know, dark matter in the way that we usually talk about knowledge, it needs to come to the forefront as we try to think about what knowledge needs to be sustained into the future. There may be some knowledge that we're ready to let go behind, but there's some knowledge that is technically bound up in, as in my understanding, the continued American project, that needs to be respected for the kind of group and collective knowledge that it is. And that's my concern.
It strikes me that it's the idea that the knowledge is not just distributed in a group, but as you kind of point out there, it's the culture of the group itself and that ongoing interactions between those group members. So
yeah.
The, in, you know, I guess the collective brains together know something that distributed, as you said, as if they kind of go off to the winds, don't fully capture that, or it's impossible to capture that.
It's impossible to capture that. Absolutely. It's impossible.
Because even it's almost like a domain error, right? That you need the group to reflect it, not the individual.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if you go off into the wilds or you try to document everything, you know, document your code or whatever, there will always be stuff you forget. And there's always the stories, you know. So this is the other thing working with spacecraft teams that have to go a really long way. For instance, there's a group trying to build an interstellar probe. And we've talked a lot about this problem of knowledge transmission, because the people who are going to build the thing are not going to be the people who fly it or the people who do research with it, because it's going to take 50 years to get there. Those people will be retired. They may be dead, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we had to think carefully about building an organizational culture that would transmit those stories. Oh, you know, this one time this error happened and we figured out how to fix it this way. And because that happened 25 years ago and the person who trained you happened to tell you that over lunch one day, you're able to fix it later on down the line. And we've seen that with projects like the Mars Exploration Rovers. We've seen that with Cassini. We saw that with Galileo. Like these longer lived missions, that transmission of knowledge, of group knowledge over the generations and as part of the collective group is absolutely crucial. Otherwise, you can't fly it. You can't operate it. You've inherited a thing that you do not understand.
Is it possible conceptually to capture all that information, or is there something that is just fundamentally distinct about certain types of experiential knowledge that cannot be codified into symbols?
I'm not sure that there's something specific that characterizes that type of knowledge as different. It has to do with what we think is relevant and also with problems of interpretation. Because we all belong to the same culture, we share in communication the same cultural substrate. So if I say brush your teeth, you know what I mean, right? And you know to use a toothbrush and not a hairbrush. But you could imagine that, you know, 500 years in the future, someone finds, you know, instructions that are like brush your teeth and they're like, what? Right? Because they don't share the same cultural framing or background. So even the way that we might write down the most, you know, considered set of instructions, it's just not going to include that. And we look at also, you know, the way that Apollo did everything with the kinds of computers they had in those days, mm-hmm. right? The people that are around building computers now actually are not even remotely trained on anything like those systems. This is like the problem with talking to Voyager, and it's still commanded in Fortran 77. And they're like, is there, you know, raise your hand if you still remember, you know, machine assembly language. Like, they don't even teach that in computer science classes anymore. My students are just, you know, they come in, they're like, yes, I know Python. Mm-hmm. You can't talk to it that way. So a lot of the knowledge is so situational, is local to the organization, is not necessarily capturable. The cultural context shifts, so you don't have an ability to interpret that without anyone to sort of serve as a guide. And then because you don't know what's relevant, you don't totally know everything to write down. It's only in the moment that someone would be like, oh, remember that one thing that happened 25 years ago and it was this bit got flipped or something, right? I mean, that's where this is why we find so much tacit knowledge, is it's stuff we can't express.
Right. It's this kind of concept of not just intuition, but mm-hmm. knowing, as you point out, this cultural context, but even you're always going to have to make some judgment about what to write down and what not to.
Sure.
And yeah. I guess we're probably really bad about understanding what is obvious to others versus our own experience. It makes me think of, there's this a great book called On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee, and it mm-hmm. contains throughout it these like first known recipes of various types of things. And, you know, so it's like from, you know, back to the Roman era or even the 1500s, and a lot of the recipes are like, add enough of this ingredient until it looks right.
Yeah, basically.
Like,
yeah.
Okay, they wrote it down, but I have no idea what it looks right. It probably seems so obvious to them, they wouldn't even bother to write it down, particularly if there's a cost to recording information, not even necessarily mm-hmm. in the physical medium these days, but the time of doing it.
Yeah.
And if you just don't know, you can always like fractalize down to details about how, you know, what to include, and then suddenly it's a pointless document if it's millions of pages long because it's telling you how to walk slowly towards the machine, you know, to begin with.
Exactly.
So kind of going back to groups, is this issue or the idea of group knowledge that is sustained, how can that be preserved then smartly? I mean, it's not, I imagine it's a more complex mm-hmm. relationship between just add more people or keep the same number of people, right? That there's some sort of application of it that doesn't a priori exclude the idea of reducing the number of people, I would assume, right?
Yeah, this is why we build institutions, Casey. Like, we build institutions and organizations to build group knowledge and then sustain it and transmit it. And when you deeply trouble that institution, when you make massive cuts to the personnel in that institution, then you threaten the ability of the institution to have any continuity in keeping that knowledge alive. That's just probably sociology of organizations 101. So are there best practices? For sure. I mean, we think a lot about knowledge management in organizational studies and theory. We think a lot about that in terms of archiving, but we also think about that in terms of mentorship and so on. In many ways, a lot of this is fracturing because of the way the labor force has fractured in the last 20 years and moved more towards contracting, but also moved more towards the kind of idea that you don't stay in an organization very long anymore. Young people, they have this idea that you move out to move up. Many of the hierarchies are broken, so you work in one place for a year and a half, and then you get a job at the next rung up, but at a different company, and then you work there for a year and a half, and then so on. And you kind of put your career together across many different places and spaces, and you sign an NDA everywhere you go, so you can't really share that information, but you're moving around this networked community within your field. And one of the problems we've had with that is that it challenges our ability to have knowledge sustainability within an organization. It's hard then to mentor somebody with, you know, how a particular thing works here and then have them leave. Now, they may always come back. They may come back at a different rung of the organization and use that knowledge, but it's made for some challenges in continuity. And then I would say also, you know, when a company is bought out, or when everybody, you know, like an entire group of leadership retires at the same time, or if you have a competitor come in and there's mass departures at the same time or randomly, that will really threaten the remaining threads of how knowledge is communicated and passed down.
You mentioned something that resonated with me, which is the idea of mentorship. Mm-hmm. And again, I keep coming back to this theme of knowledge is basically a product of interpersonal engagements. Mm-hmm. And again, you've studied this very closely is it a small scale? I guess I don't know like the range of teams that sociologists study, but you know, within
call it
like
the meso scale.
Yeah, within NASA yeah. mission teams. Mm-hmm. How does that effectively kind of address some of these? Is it just purely by watch me what I do, and then through that you're just kind of taking in all of this nonverbal, non-written down information in a more whole, because we're just using multiple senses? Or is this something, and maybe the extension of that, is that something that's possible or degraded then through remote work? Does this require in-person presence?
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges associated with remote work. I've given several talks about this as well, and they're well-known challenges. So I'll mention that we've studied remote work for 40 years. So we know what makes it work, and we know what makes it not work. And we studied it also from within tech companies that were outsourcing newly in the 1980s and the 1990s to places like India and so on. And then we were able to implement best practices in some of those units, right, which was great. And then when the pandemic happened, everybody took every best practice and flipped it on its head and did the exact opposite. So in fact, it broke a lot of teams as opposed to being able to produce continuity. And that doesn't mean remote work can't work. It just means that the kind of remote work that we implemented then was dysfunctional, and was dysfunctional in ways that, like, we could have told you in advance, and many of us were trying to say something about during the moment. So yes, remote work can be a challenge to this, and we've also studied that, like how remote teams, they usually get together on a cadence, right? They have meetings in person, they go visit each other's work sites to get a sense of the common ground for communication and the way that an organization functions and how they make decisions there. And that's really the glue that holds these organizations together, even when they work remotely for long periods of time. It's not even necessarily a question of quantifiable knowledge that's transferred. It's ways to approach problems. So the best kind of mentorship I've seen happens in teams as they're trying to solve a problem together. That's where the tacit knowledge really comes out. So if you're in an engineering team, like you're all about solving problems. You've got 5 people or 8 people, and you're all trying to put a system together, and you've got your different subsystems, and you're trying to figure out how they're going to piece together as like puzzle pieces. And you've got challenges, you've got problems. Is there enough power? Is there enough data? Is there enough, you know? And it's in that group work that people learn not only how we solve problems around here, but they also learn or pick up the, oh, yeah, well, last time we did it this way. Or, oh, hey, this is kind of an unusual piece of equipment. Let me tell you about it, right? those are the kinds of things that happen when you're working on shared tasks. So it isn't so much like my mentor took me for coffee today and he told me XYZ, which I'm now my knowledge has been transferred. You know, it's mm-hmm. more we are working together in a group and the mentorship is in the task and the group culture is in the task. Every time we get together and we try to build this thing or we try to fly that thing or we try to come up with a solution to a problem, we're producing and we're engaging in that kind of group knowledge.
It strikes me as the difference between a participatory versus passive yes. relationship to this yeah. information.
And that's why it's not like codifiable. It's so situated. It's so in the moment. It's quite ephemeral and is really personal and it's interpersonal. So that makes it the kind of thing that we culturally haven't spent a lot of time being attuned to. And in fact, we often poo-poo it. We're like, well, that's just sort of messy social sciencey stuff, you know, but that is actually the human glue that enables these big projects to succeed. And I think that's also what attracts me to places like NASA. These are people doing complicated, incredibly complex things, things that have never been done before. You know, JPL's motto is dare mighty things together for a reason. They're doing mighty and difficult and, you know, first time things. And they're doing it in teams. And the teams have to be optimized for precisely approaching those challenges. And that means that they're not coming to it entirely afresh. They're coming to it with the experience of 60 years of meeting similar kinds of challenges and building on that knowledge together to approach the next challenge. And that, I think, is what makes a place like NASA so fascinating for someone like me, is because that social messy stuff is actually what makes these things fly.
Is there a flip side of 90s at NASA? It seems, and like I have in my head this image of taking this big group brain and then just poking random holes in it as people depart. Mm-hmm. And that's like the unstrategic outcome, right? That the group brain is just missing pieces, whether they were important or not to that institutional transfer. There wasn't a way to evaluate and ensure that you had a functioning brain at the end of it.
So you
is
said
that too weird of a visual.
No, I think you're. I'm trying to say, yeah, you're right. But here's what makes it even more devastating. Okay, so first of all, 30,000 employees at NASA, Google has 180,000. So let's get real about the scale we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, okay? NASA itself, I mean, has only. I was that was like at the peak of Apollo, it was 36,000.
Oh, great!
Right, like, and this
so
is
what
I
is it now?
Around 18,000.
18,000. So Google is 10 times larger than NASA. And how many things has it landed on the moon? So, you know, this is a small organization for the weight of the things it is doing. Second, as you well know, Casey, NASA is not a singular entity. NASA, from the beginning, had competition built into it through the distribution of various centers. So there's Marshall that does more propulsion. There's, you know, Houston, which does the human spaceflight. There's launch capabilities in Florida. And there's, you know, robotics out at, you know, JPL. And there's the wind tunnel at Ames. You know, I could go on. But there's local knowledge specific. Talk about distributed cognition, specific to different parts of a spacecraft system. And that encourages when NASA spends money, first of all, that there's competition so that you can keep the prices relatively low, reminding us that these are all bespoke objects, right, that they're building, but also enables us to spread the money from the federal government, which is not a lot of money, to lots of different places around the country. And that was purposeful in terms of how NASA was set up. So it is already starved for people to try to do the enormity of the things it is trying to do. And it's also starved for money of the enormity of the things it's trying to do. I mean, the budget we're talking about at NASA, this is like a teeny fraction of a penny off of every, you know, U.S. tax dollar. And when you look at something like planetary science, it's even smaller than that. And the budgets are, you know, going up and down and up and down all the time, mostly down. Sometimes they're up a little bit, but they're not up a lot, right? From, you know, we're way down from where we were under Apollo and even under Viking. So yeah,
and if they do go up, maybe the money shows up 6 months into your fiscal year.
Shows up at the wrong time. Yeah. So there is a well-established development curve for the way we build new technologies. It's the technology development curve. It kind of looks a bit like a wave where it goes down for a bit, which that's where you put a lot of money into it in R&D. And then it swoops up and that's where you get all the revenue because it all works out in the end. And NASA can't do that because it can't go into the red. It can't have a slush fund lying around for R&D. You know, private companies, if they start going over on R&D, they can start moving money over from different places. They can charge commercial satellites a little bit more than they would otherwise in order to have the money around for a particular project. And NASA, as a federal agency, cannot do that. It cannot move the money that way. So when you restrict funds and you restrict personnel, and then you start poking holes in these institutions, which are already pretty small and fragile for the kind of work that they're trying to do, you have tremendous fragility and loss of knowledge that's basically on the line. And you might think, oh, well, we're just making it more efficient. We're just making it more efficient because we're getting rid of the people. But actually, in my research in the history of NASA and the history of these missions, that makes it less efficient because you don't have the resources to get the job done. And so you end up trying to sort of rely on other factors or other things, or have gaps in your knowledge, or rely on, like, you know, a free instrument from the French or something in order to, you know, get you through these impossible budget caps. And then it turns out, oh, wait a minute, the French are late, so we slipped the Mars launch window, so it's going to be an extra 2 years and however many $100 million that is, right? So it turns out when you lose the people and you starve these institutions of funding, you actually cripple their capability to behave efficiently.
Well, again, it just strikes me as this idea, again, if the knowledge and the knowledge transfer process requires interaction between people, if you want that knowledge transfer to happen, and if you want them to be able to tackle these really difficult problems, you basically need to give them the time to interact with each other.
You need to give them people time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can't shortcut that. You can't.
No.
Make that cheaper, and
no, you
know, the cost of labor is just always
people are expensive.
Yeah,
let me give you a good example of this, Casey. So the Psyche mission, for instance, which had a launch delay, which was not related to this particular problem. I sat on the Psyche IRB, and Psyche was one of those missions that decided to go with a commercial satellite bus from a small organization called Maxar at the time that was producing commercial satellites. And they were trying to get them ready for, they wanted to move into the deep space market. And so this was an opportunity to work with JPL to prepare their satellites for deep space, which is, as your listeners may or may not know, outside of Earth orbit is like a really different context. So just because you get something into Earth orbit says nothing about what's going to happen once you get farther out from Earth and once you're into deep space. So it actually requires quite a lot of work. And the PI of that mission, Lindy Elkins-Tanton, and her project manager spent a ton of time going back and forth between JPL in Pasadena and where Maxar was based in the Bay Area, back and forth, and making sure that those groups like came to visit JPL and the JPLers went to visit them. And they had such a tight team. That group really understood each other. And the problem with Psyche had nothing to do with that. So when people first came in, they were like, well, you know, we've seen this problem before, that these are two different organizations and they just aren't talking to each other. No, no, no. They put in the time and the effort. The other thing I will mention about that is expensive. It costs money to go visit. It costs money to have people that are really spending the time to make sure the pieces fit together. Well, however, it only costs that money on the front end, because once you've invested in those relationships and that knowledge transfer, the knowledge flows. And then you're way better equipped later on down the line to fix problems as they come up. And they did come up for Psyche. And because that relationship was so tight, they were able to fix those problems. But if they hadn't spent the money up front on that integration between those two organizations, they wouldn't have been able to do it, and they wouldn't have been able to solve the problems. This is important to this question about knowledge and knowledge transfer, because when we talk about wanting to use money associated with NASA to invigorate a private spaceflight sector, the way to do it is to do what Psyche did with Maxar. It's to say, okay, let's get a really capable team at a NASA center, could be Goddard, could be, you know, Langley or whatever, and get them working really closely with a private space provider, because it's in that relationship that the knowledge will transfer and they'll be able to do something really exciting. Getting rid of people at NASA who know how to do the things and assuming they'll just find their way to, you know, Blue Origin or Intuitive Machines or something and like do it there, that's not how the knowledge works. That's not how knowledge transfer works. And so, in fact, you'll lose those capabilities as opposed to retaining them. And another great example is, you know, Langley like stepped in and helped Intuitive Machines when it turned out their landing mechanism was failing as they're trying to land on the moon. And it was the relationship between Intuitive Machines and the NASA Center that enabled that mission to make it down to the surface. So these like, I'm not saying it's you know, private versus public, because actually at NASA, it's always been both. But if you're trying to think about how you do a knowledge infusion from a public organization to a private one, it's not through these, you know, random cuts to the public one in the hopes that somehow the private will pick it up. You have to do it through extended collaboration between two organizations and institutions to be sure that knowledge transfers.
We'll be right back with the rest of our Space Policy Edition of Planetary Radio after this short break.
Greetings, Bill Nye here. The U.S. Congress approves NASA's annual budget, and with your support, we promote missions to space by keeping every member of Congress and their staff informed about the benefits of a robust space program. We want Congress to know that space exploration ensures our nation's goals in workforce technology, international relations, and space science. Unfortunately, important missions are being delayed, some indefinitely. That's where you come in. Join our mission as a space advocate by making a gift today. Right now, when you donate, your gift will be matched up to $75,000 thanks to a generous Planetary Society member. With your support, we can make sure every representative and senator in D.C. understands why NASA is a critical part of U.S. national policy. With the challenges NASA is facing, we need to make this investment today. So make your gift at planetary.org/takeaction. Thank you.
I'm reminded of how Europa Clipper team discovered that they had an issue with the transistors.
Yeah, so the MOSFETs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they were basically randomly were at a conference and someone came up to, I think it was like someone just came up to the engineer and said, hey, you know, we're having this issue. Are you aware of it?
Yeah, you may want to check this out.
Yeah.
Well, and actually the MOSFETs are a great example because, you know, that could have been that could have sunk the mission. I mean, there were hundreds of those things, right? They're like, you know, it's just like, how do we solve this problem? And it turned out that because the project manager had friends and colleagues who worked at other NASA centers and at private space providers and at private companies, like they worked together across those relationships to figure out the problem. And that solved it for far less money. I mean, I can't even imagine how much more expensive it would have been if there'd been a launch slip accordingly. And because there was knowledge transfer, there were relationships, there was like organizational, you know, connection there, that knowledge could flow and the problem could be solved. And, you know, these are the stories I think are so fascinating about NASA, is it really is about how people work together to solve really hard problems. We keep thinking it's just about the kind of whiz-bang rockets and stuff, but actually we forget that there's people and organizations and cultures and relationships that are behind every single one of those things. And if those relations are going awry, you're going to have trouble with the technology as well.
Well, I mean, another way to think of this is how much if the government was trying to save money by preventing their experts from going to conferences, maybe they would have saved a few thousand dollars on that, whoever
exactly
at that conference, and then they would have lost a $5 billion spacecraft when it
exactly
first started Jupiter, right? And
exactly.
And that relationship wouldn't have even been obvious in retrospect. Like, we wouldn't have even known that was the opportunity to fix it.
We had this problem on Europa Clipper where I was an embedded social scientist and member of the team. And very early on, in order to save money, Europa Clipper was asked to like not meet in person for a year. Oh, this is at a time when they have to be doing a ton of thoughtful, integrative work, thinking about how are the pieces of the spacecraft going to fit together. They had to be doing the relationship building. They had to be doing the knowledge transfer. That was where the mentorship needed to happen. That was where the stories of, oh, we did it this way on Galileo, and so this is going to be helpful. That's where all of that knowledge transfer needed to happen. And to be told then, oh, you don't get to meet, meant that it couldn't happen. And we struggled to figure out how do we replace those contexts? Because also at the time, under austerity restrictions, scientists weren't also allowed to go to scientific meetings, right? Like they were showing up at the AGU on their own dime because they were restricted from travel because they believed it was so important to be there to make sure that this work, this human, social, collective, interactive knowledge work needed to get done. And again, it's these sort of short-sighted things like, you know, penny wise and pound foolish, that it looked like it was going to save so much money. And in the long term, missing that opportunity to build those relationships costs you in the long run.
I've been really obsessed recently about what is easily measurable and what isn't.
Yes.
And that we optimize for the easily measurable stuff. And so it's easy to measure. I'm going to stop people from traveling to conferences and I will save a couple $100,000 this year.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't measure the that 3 year later consequence of delayed spacecraft or inefficient design or any number of things, right? Because there's not a clear causal link mm-hmm. between the two of those. And you end up kind of incentivizing bad decisions like this, or maybe not fully strategic decisions for what are you actually trying to do in a long, or any kind of long-term thinking maybe is the essence of it. We've talked in a sense a lot about NASA. Is NASA distinct in your observations for how these teams work? Is there something unique about either what NASA does and maybe implied this a bit with like the space being this profoundly unforgiving domain to work in, the visibility of it, or just the complexity of it? Is NASA in a sense a unique institution to think about workforce knowledge transfer versus others?
I mean, yes and no. One of the things that's interesting about NASA is that people tend to work in those teams for much longer. The space community is relatively small, even with the new entrants in new space. People tend to pretty much know each other. It's not as sprawling as, say, biotech or medicine or bioengineering or so on. So these are communities that actually know each other and they work together for incredibly long periods of time. Like, we started working with Europa Clipper I started working with them in 2009. They weren't even a mission yet. They were selected in like 2015, started in 2016, and they didn't launch until last October. And they're not going to get there until, 2030 or 2032?
Mm-hmm.
So, it felt like this working on Cassini. They talked about being there for births and deaths and marriages. Like, you're in for the long haul on some of these missions. They take a really long time. And that also makes them very vulnerable to political shifts and changes, which they're aware of. If you're in the middle of something and suddenly there's a new administration that comes in and says, no, we don't want you to do that, you're in trouble. This also happened to a very small mission, Contour, which was run by APL many years ago under Faster, Better, Cheaper. And it just so happened, they're trying to put this together in like 30 months, which is nothing for spacecraft. And in the middle of it, there's a federal election. And then there was like a labor dispute. And all of a sudden, all civil servant workers, their salaries went up. And so that completely blew through their budget, right? But they couldn't have predicted that. So there's some things about space that are unique. One is that people work together for these incredibly long periods of time. Two, they're very politically sensitive because they have only a single point of funding, and that's a single point of failure. And when you're talking about, especially about deep space, I mean, there's been changes with these, opening up of near Earth and sublunary orbit, et cetera, to private players. But there's, in deep space, you have to be reliant on government and multi-governmental funding agencies and space agencies, and you're subject to different legal regulations associated with space. And then you're also subject to really different environmental conditions in deep space. I mean, planning, it's not just landing something on Mars, but even getting it to Mars, that takes a lot of tacit knowledge and distributed cognition for sure. So it's highly specialized knowledge. It's highly subject to major slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. It's also very physical work. A lot of studies have taken place of software engineering teams. And when you're working with software, like, there's a materiality to software, but it's a lot easier to pivot than when you're trying to build a thing with the kind of precision that will get it to Jupiter, and it's the size of a school bus, right? That's a really different kind of phenomenon. And then the teams will work together for decades, right? So they know each other incredibly well. And there's no big change. I mean, there's not really big changes. I remember talking to a friend who does organizational sociology in the private sector, and they were just so surprised that, like, the PIs have the same role forever. It's like a lifetime appointment. There's no, removal. We're seeing that increasingly in the private sector, too, with certain sort of charismatic CEOs, but there isn't a kind of move out philosophy, particularly among the top and particularly in science. Now, that said, there's a lot about NASA that's really similar to other organizations. It's work. It's a workplace. It's a workplace where people are really mission-driven, though. I mean, they're really committed to the public idea of space exploration and doing this for the the glory of mankind and for humankind, for the Earth, for America. Like they're really committed to the mission of NASA. But it's a workplace, you know, you go to work every day, you've got problems you've got to solve, you've got people you're working with, you've got too many emails and messages coming in on Slack and people tweeting things in the middle of stuff, right? So it's in many ways, some of the interactions locally are quite familiar, and you'd almost forget that what's happening here is people are trying to go into space.
How has technology changed the transfer of knowledge or any of these kind of team dynamics? You said you've been doing this for 20 years studying NASA teams. Mm-hmm. A lot's changed, right? I mean, things like Slack or Google Sheets, collaborative editing.
Yeah, those kinds of technologies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, have any of those fundamentally changed these dynamics or reduced this need for interpersonal, in-person engagements?
No, those technologies were only ever built to continue to support remote work in which there was a cadence of in-person interaction. They were built coming out of that period of time when we were studying remote teams and how to do distributed collaboration, and the idea was that still people would get together. So they can sustain for a long time, but they won't sustain forever. I think, you know, I've seen changes. When I first started working on the Mars Exploration Rover, everything happened on teleconference calls, and there was a Polycom system that kind of sometimes worked, and there was a, you know, off-the-shelf camera that sat in the corner somewhere to, you know, now people are talking on, you know, on Slack or on Mattermost or whatever. I think what's interesting now is you have to remember these are multi-institutional collaborations. So if you were one of the 180,000 people who work at Google, you have a whole bunch of Google tools. You have your Google computer, you have all the Google G Suite, I presume, that you do all your work on, and that's how it is. But if you are JPL and you have a Cisco WebEx contract and a Slack contract for government work, and then you're at APL, but at APL has a Zoom government contract and a Mattermost for work, you can't talk to each other. So ironically, in some ways, even though we have a proliferation of these collaborative workplace tools, they've kind of created a paradoxical situation where on the one hand, we think we can just use them and never see each other, which is not true. And then secondly, we can't even really talk to each other because it's like, whose meeting room are we using today, right? So I have seen those things cause a problem. And then of course, in the period of remote work under the pandemic, where people weren't just working remotely from, you know, different teams, they were working remotely from each other. It was like an atomization of work. There was a lot of isolation and a lot of knowledge that was lost and couldn't be transferred. One of the things we found on the Psyche mission was that because people weren't coming in because of the pandemic, information couldn't really get around. And at JPL, there's this cafeteria that everyone goes to at lunch, and you see everyone that you've worked with on other projects. And, you know, other organizations are like this too, right? If you go to Google with their five-star chefs in the cafeteria, like, you see everyone and you're having a really good meal, right? And that's where the knowledge is shared. It's in these informal settings is where that tacit knowledge sort of comes out and that mentorship happens. And the pandemic broke that. It broke that for so many organizations, not just at NASA, but elsewhere. There was a great paper that came out of a study team by Microsoft, for instance, and Microsoft could do this because it was one, a single organization with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and everyone's on Microsoft Teams, and they could analyze what happened to everyone's communication. And they were using the same tools that they'd been using, you know, 3 weeks beforehand or in January of 2020. But by the time they were into March of 2020 and, you know, December of 2020, all of the informal interactions had dropped out. Everyone was only talking to their closest ties and their closest collaborators. So the innovation that happens when you put people together, the knowledge transfer that happens when you put people together across units, the informal interactions that enable mentorship and enable knowledge transfer to take place were gone, absolutely gone. And this paper is fantastic because they draw out the social network analysis and you're like, well, that's pretty fragmented. And we saw that at NASA as well. So as we did in all kinds of organizations. So does it require face-to-face work? It requires a cadence of face-to-face work. It doesn't mean that you have to be face-to-face all the time, but it does mean there has to be a regular cadence of face-to-face to enable the use of those tools over the long term, as opposed to thinking we can just rely on these tools.
As we're talking right now, we're in this weird interregnum where we know that reduction in force at NASA, RIF, is coming, mm-hmm. but we don't know what it looks like. And mm-hmm. it seems to be dynamic even internally. But that's been on top of this encouraged early retirement, mm-hmm. you know, taking anyone. I think NASA lost 5% of its workforce just from that. Other agencies have seen obviously much worse layoffs. And this idea of just reducing the number of people, it seems like just for the sake of reduction as a de facto good thing. Does this require, again, I think we've established that this is probably not the best idea to maintain institutional knowledge transfer, but I think, you know, if pressed, I would say, you know, particularly from some of the more tech-minded individuals, and we've seen this on Silicon Valley side, I'll say maybe they would present this, well, we don't need as many people now because AI, whether now or in a few years, that will be a big enough and complex enough that it can hold, unlike a human brain, it will be able to hold the full complexity of landing on the moon. It will be able to hold the full complexity of landing on Mars on it. So we don't need people in the same way. Do you think that's how would you respond, I guess, to that framing that there's, oh, these new technologies are coming anyway that'll reduce this need, so we don't need to pay as many people off of government taxpayer dollars?
Well, the first thing I'd say is it's not a lot of government taxpayer dollars already. Secondly, I would say, but it isn't. I would say that, like, if you wanted to make sure that we never visited another planet or successfully really landed on the moon in the next 15 years or maybe 20 or maybe more, this would be the way to do it. So it depends what you're going for, right? And I can think of no better way.
Where do you put this kind of, I mean, AI, obviously, lots of fantastical claims about it, but in terms
oh,
of...
Oh, about AI. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in terms from a sociological, like your field studying it,
yeah.
How is this seen as both a, how it's being, I guess I'm trying to frame this as, I see a lot of actors, let's just
will
say...
Will AI fix it?
AI will fix it, but also that it'll be the stand-in for... an individual at some level.
We have this amazing mythology in our culture that it doesn't matter how often we prove it wrong, we still believe it, that if you bring in machines, the work will be more productive and efficient. And it never actually works because machines actually take more people, and they often take more skilled people or different kinds of people than you had before. And so you see a change in your labor force composition. But in fact, in many ways, you're paying for more people to be doing more of the work. Sometimes it's just associated with keeping up the machinery. So, and we saw this with, you know, early industrialization. We've seen this with computerization in the 1980s. There's this promise we're going to bring in this magical new tech and it will change everything. And technology doesn't change everything. It comes into existing social context and it will like have a lensing effect on that social context. It will reveal that context in sometimes in sort of its grotesqueness of its features, but it doesn't make it more efficient. I hate to you know pop your dreams here, but it never has. The other thing
I guess we've seen the reduction like of manufacturing jobs in the United States, right? That's kind of
moved the manufacturing jobs in the United States just because you moved them and because you replaced things with machinery and then other people have to take care of the machinery and you made it not your job to pay those people because it's another company that pays those people and they're trying to pay those people less. That doesn't mean you don't have people. You still have people.
And I guess that's the dynamics change. And this is kind of what I'm getting at a little bit with this, which is if the idea, particularly again from the Silicon Valley cohort that's kind of in the administration right now, that I would say that they would take at face value that people can be replaced to a certain extent and you just need fewer people to manage the AIs who are going to do all this grand thinking and so forth. And it's a difficult thing to talk about because at a certain level, it's like, well, if you assert magic, then what's the...
I don't know how to confront,
and,
you know.
And maybe we'll get... But this idea that can you add some sort of... I guess that's what I was getting back with my original question. Are there ways to capture some of these interactions and knowledge that even into a different type of system that is then able to, through whatever complex computation it has, capture or regurgitate them in a way that you just don't need as many people? I mean, because we have fewer jobs, a lot have been outsourced, but I think it's true that we have much more advanced robots than we did building cars 30 years ago. Like there's a productivity gain from the application of technology in a lot of sectors. Could this be in the information sector or design sector or whatever we would spacecraft building sector as well.
So there's two answers to that. One is that most of the sociological studies of AI have demonstrated that it's pretty much people all the way down. So there's a level of computation, and then there's like people cleaning the data. There's people in Nigeria writing answers. There's people in the Philippines. There's like, these people are not necessarily visible to you, but there's a lot of people involved in making AI look like it's doing everything all by itself. So the idea that AI comes in and replaces people, no, it just displaces people. It makes those people invisible to you. One of my favorite new books by my colleague, Ben Shestakovsky at University of Pennsylvania, was in an AI startup that became a unicorn. And it was fascinating because it got VC funding. And as a result, it had to demonstrate growth that was so astronomical that all their software engineers had to interview new software engineers to grow. And so most of their software engineers were too busy interviewing software engineers to actually build the software. So